So we are about to say farewell to October, and the first half of the semester is now dead and gone, and we have looming ahead of us a giant paper to write, and I've gotten in a number of reading lists from my faithful graduate students. The unfaithful graduate students haven't yet sent theirs. But that will soon all be finished, and we're going to post a. I think by Tuesday I'll have this thing ready to be on Blackboard, and it'll be long, about 10 pages, but it'll have little windows at certain points that encapsulate the special annotated items that everybody has chosen. So that'll be some help for you. I think. On the whole, I think it's a big development. We're going to have a collectively produced Dostoevsky recommended bibliography, and I think that's a great thing. Not just Dostoevsky, but Russian novel and Russian culture. So, looking forward to getting our first edition of that posted with credits. No important advertisers. Now the paper, as the syllabus said, this paper should develop an insight into Dostoevsky's vision as an artist and thinker. So we are not looking for a scholarly paper that traces a historical theme or an iconographic theme or something like that, and doesn't attempt to be historical or objective, although we don't expect you to be utterly cavalier with history or iconography as far as that goes, but rather to use your paper as a chance to explore what Dostoevsky has given us to look at and to ask yourself a question about some of the meaning of some of the important central themes that lie close to his work.
Mm-hmm. Is it okay to focus on just like one of the books?
You may. They're long books. And so
one long book is better than 30 long books.
There you are. Yeah. Yeah. Now what I'm going to suggest as some themes, let me just mention, I'm going to mention about 10 possible themes. Don't want you to think of these as indicating the exact focus. They're going to be broader than what your focus should be. But they should point you in a good direction, okay? And again, you can apply them to one novel or to several. Our undergraduates often find it easier to write a long paper about several novels. That gives you a chance to change gears as you move on, and that's all right as long as it all fits together and works progressively. But I would think, since we've talked a great deal about it, carnivalization. Or polyphony in Dostoevsky's novels, a particular mythic figure in Dostoevsky's novels. This is a little more tricky because, of course, Dostoevsky doesn't make any explicit references to mythic figures, but the figure of the sun, right? The brothers, right? The earth mother, right? The roots of this figure should be examined, if that's possible, looking in the history of Russian culture. But more important than that, meaning, as Dostoevsky explores it, as part of the background depth of some of his important characters. In such a paper, it would be important probably to discuss that figure in more than one novel. Romanticism in Dostoevsky's view. All right. This is not to be confused with romanticism. In other words, if I were teaching romanticism, I would give a generally favorable spin on it. Okay, not without criticism, but I think we've heard Dostoevsky on the romantic dreamer, in the idiot, in the possessed, and now certainly also to an extent in the brothers. So. What does he mean? What is up with that? What if that topic attracts you, explore that in your own way. Similarly, nihilism in Dostoevsky's works. If you want to think of an anatomy of nihilism in his works, that would be demanding. But there could be a number of ways you could focus that topic and make it quite revealing and interesting. Suffering, of course, that's been indicated as a highly Russian theme, is one certainly dear to Dostoevsky. Similarly, death and resurrection, especially since that's going to come to the fore very much in The Brothers. Those are some very heavy and very deep and very central topics. There are also some sidelights that are of considerable interest, like Dostoevsky and Roman Catholicism, which, you know, again, is not to be confused with Roman Catholicism. He has a particular grudge on Roman Catholicism. It's actually not without a reasonable, he has his reasons for holding them. But it would be worth looking into, and there has been some critical and scholarly work done on it. And you could look in his Diary of a Writer, I think, to see more. Dostoevsky and visual art, because there seems to play an especially intense role in his works. So I would think you'd want to look up what it is that the icon has special about it, as well as Western painting. But again, you would shape that in a way that you would find most interesting and most revealing. Dostoevsky and parody. We've talked about several related notions of the way that Dostoevsky will take an idea and parody it. We've talked about what else besides parody? Heresy, I believe, was one way of doing that.
And then there's the demonic.
And there is, of course, the demonic. Yes. Thank you.
Oh my goodness. Well, the stories from the Bible, for example, episodes from scripture, sacred scripture, that come up as parallel text mm-hmm. in the novels, parallel to events sometimes, but sometimes they come up in unusual context mm-hmm. that you don't expect. Such as Smerdyakov's taking the faith that moves mountains passage.
Yes.
And
yes.
That turns it into an absurdity, of course.
Right. So, just another example of a travesty.
Yeah, that is a parody. But then it's not always parodic.
No. So are there more references to the Bible in this novel than in? Yeah, certainly it's more so than in The Idiot or The Possessed. So. Another possibility is to do some sort of comparison of the novelists that we've studied, as long as the focus is on Dostoevsky and as long as in some way it reveals the particular genius of Dostoevsky. So comparison and contrast of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, of course that's been done, but again, if it's something you want to explore, find a way that's particular to your interest and that you think you can get a fresh insight into. Dostoevsky's inheritance from Gogol, likewise. Dostoevsky and Turgenev. Dostoevsky's love-hate relationship with Turgenev. Yes. Okay. So I hope those are some helpful ideas as you want to get started early in the season, just as it's still a little too early for the stores to bring out their Christmas decorations, but it's not too early to begin thinking about your term paper.
Oh, one more maybe is the theme of exile.
Good, yeah, because we haven't really talked about that, but it is prominent in so many of his works. It's crucial to The Idiot. Now, we had said undergraduates should have at least six sources besides the novels, and we're aiming at a 10-page minimum on our undergrads. For graduates, a 15-page minimum, and at least 12 sources besides the law. So. All right.
Would you like us to come in and discuss our topics with you?
Yes, I'd like to start doing that. I hope to do it next week. We'll send around some sign-up sheets, and I'll set aside some time for you. I look forward to doing that and get to know you a little bit better. That would be great. Okay. All right, so we start then on the culmination of Dostoevsky's work, which is also really the culmination of his vision. These were not simply a series of novels he wrote because he got some sudden ideas, but the more we read, the more we attend to the intense concerns of each of these novels, the more we see an evolution, a development of his vision. And we know also that he died soon after the completion of the Brothers Karamazov. So this, in this way, this was the work toward which he had been struggling with the production of his other novels. We can, in a sense, we can see some of this in that we see certain other characters transformed and certain character types that he reuses and does variations on in The Brothers. There is, in a sense, something that he kept trying to get at with each novel. There is a figure in the carpet, as Henry James calls it, right? That is not in the plot or the characters themselves. It is something beneath, and is something connected to that mysterious process whereby the novelist has a particular insight, a particular intuition that he begins with, and as we see in Dostoevsky's notebooks, he will write a whole plot and then tear it up and write a different plot in order to try to stay with that thing that has taken possession of him. We'd like to think of that as not merely random and sequential possession, and in the greatest artist it is not, but it is quest. Caroline Gordon, and not nearly as great a figure, but the author of 11 novels, said, "My stories are all one story." And I think there are novelists that think of it that way. Although what she meant by that involved completely different characters and completely different time frames and so forth. My stories are all one story. I keep telling it over and over again. And I think that can be said, that can be true of Dostoevsky as well. So what is the myth then that lies behind each plot? His job, you know, is not simply to make Christians of us, although he's writing a novel that is full of religious themes and religious ideas. But it's rather, I think if we can think how he must have conceived of it, it was perhaps to keep alive something that he considers natural to human beings. A piety and a love toward the people, toward one's own people, toward the earth, with all of the overtones that he gives that image. The kind of love that the enlightened person, the modern, has only scorn for, as we and this becomes a kind of theme in this novel as well, that if we're truly enlightened, if we want to be accepted into the cocktail parties and elsewhere, we cannot allow ourselves to be pinned down to being partisans of any small group, unless it's a soccer team, of course. That's very fashionable. Running completely counter to that is the notion of subornost, of community, the inherent kinship of all the Russians. insight that we are kin to each other has to begin with that intense love of a small group, of that is one's own. And I think through that, he is trying to indicate what it is to be part of the mystical body. It is an intuitive sense that is largely vanished in our individualistic time. Not an intellectual matter, not a matter that can be proved, but something that he's getting at. And one has to get at this through a kind of ladder of analogies that he provides for us that's necessary if we are to love genuinely at all and not just get lost in dreams and the illusory love of universals. This theme invokes Madame Kolakoff, and we already see early in the novel, confesses to Father Zosima how hard it is to love those who are near you and how easy it is to love all of humanity in the abstract. This is an old theme. It was even present in an early Peanuts comic strip, as Lucy once said, "I love mankind, it's people I can't stand." Right? It's an old paradox. But it becomes a strong concern in Dostoevsky's novels, and it then just becomes open and explicit here in Father Zosima's remarks in The Brothers. We've seen Dostoevsky's carnivalistic and polyphonic strain that runs as so close to the heart of his art in dealing with people. Right, if we talk about people and his concern with people, there is no one mouthpiece of his views. There are no foils. There are some foils, to be sure, but there is always a vast array of people who have a partial grip on the truth, who have something interesting, something captivating to say, although they may be consumptive, epileptic, handicapped in a number of ways, but contribute to the overall mosaic that he's developing. We've commented on that. But what I think we see, in addition, in The Brothers Karamazov, is an important aspect of novels in general, not all novels, right? But it's latent within the novel, and those few of you who are here who studied theory of the novel with me last semester will back me up on this, I hope, and that is that his writing is epic. The Brothers Karamazov brings out the epic nature of his undertakings in the novels much more clearly than anything before that he has written. And through him, we're able to say novels are inherently epic. They're about the health of a culture. They're about a people. This was something that, again, developed in the 19th century as novels came to be inclusive and increasingly about the development of a people, of a nation. But especially then, in Dostoevsky. We've seen it already with Gogol and his Troika at the end of Dead Souls. It's an implicit theme running through the novel. The novel is about the question of the fulfillment of a people's destiny, the depiction of their work together in the making of their culture. The tragedy they have to suffer together becomes epic because they suffer it together. And a novelist as remote in our pantheon as James Fenimore Cooper tells us something about the epic nature of America. Not to mention Herman Melville and so forth. We go on from there. But what we see in The Brothers are certainly a few very strong concerns that he returns to. One is, what is Russian? Right? It's a constant concern in the novel. What characterizes us as a people, and as critical and as satirical as it may be, it's about us, the Russians, right? So, and we readers have to kind of adopt our Russianness for while we're reading Dostoevsky, I think. There's just no way out. That concern with the hero, that open concern with the hero, which, as we've been emphasizing, both Dr. Dupree and I have been emphasizing, has been a concern with Russian literature from the beginning of the 19th century, desire for a positive hero. But it's so openly discussed here in The Brothers. And then also the way that he takes the more positive aspects of Russian culture, those most positive Russian cultural formations, and creates an apotheosis out of them. And I'm thinking especially of the elder, right, the Starets, and Zosima. He is not just, right, you know, a great spiritual figure, a portrait of a great spiritual figure. He is Russian through and through. And in that sense, he's the production of the collective wisdom of the people. Now, there has been a good book written about Russian novels and their epic tendencies, and that's called Novel Epics. I forget, it's two authors, and I can't, whose names I can never remember quite, but it's a pretty good book. Before them, Mikhail Bakhtin wrote a little essay called Epic and Novel. And it's an interesting piece. You read it with, if you have the kind of background in epic reading that the University of Dallas gives to its students, while you tend to say, well, he's underrating Homer. You know, I've never thought that, you know, Bakhtin gives Homer his due, because he says, oh, epics, you know, they make everything seem so grand and distant and so magnificent that you could never possibly touch them, you know, and so forth. Well, he's really talking about the epic from the point of view of the novel. What does a novel do that adds to the epic? It brings it up close. And that certainty of the ancient epic is changed to that polyphony, multi-voicedness, the dialogicality, that nobody has a single grip on the truth, and this, the inherent skepticism of the narrative technique of the novel. And this is an inherent distanciation from the events that are told. The narrator is a modern, whether he, you know, holds modern views or not. He is structurally a modern, removed from the events themselves, filtering them through his consciousness. And Dostoevsky makes a great matter of the fact of, with his narrator, by telling us, you know, some say this, I heard this, it was said in the village, you know, and so forth. He goes on in this way, stressing the way in which the stuff that he gets, the picture that he makes of what happens, was put together at second and third hand. All of this has an effect on the modern, and we really have to think of novels as the great carriers of the epic tradition after the end of the great epics sometime in the Renaissance. All of this has an effect on how epic action reaches us and reaches our consciousness. So that note of uncertainty and skepticism never quite disappears in his works. And all that, you know, becomes a part of the fabric of the Brothers Karamazov. Okay. Now, if we could boil down the myth that Dostoevsky keeps coming back to, if I'm not wrong about the idiot, and if we take what we have distilled from the possessed and see it again in the action of the brothers, we would see that's our Father, who represents wisdom and sacred authority, and an earth mother, guiding their son, a young hero of nobility and courage, who is spurred on by his love for a beautiful woman to lead his people into truth and justice. Largely, this doesn't happen in so many of his novels, but it seems to be set. It seems to be in the cards. It seems to be the setup. It seems to be what is called for. Now, also, we should note that this young hero is to lead and is to succeed, if that's even the right word, by suffering, and not necessarily by winning. Right? Perhaps by suffering and losing and dying. And in this, this is the particular Russian myth, and does go back to Prince Igor. And if we could look closely at the Lay of Prince Igor, we could see much of this myth laid out and looked at most forthrightly. But the Western myth has always been one of success. It may take an early hit, but you go on and you make the city and you make the empire. So forth. Now it seems that, you know, in the past 150 years, that's likely to have changed in the West. That authors like Melville look at the humble Ishmael as of equal, if not greater, importance than the proud Captain Ahab, and that it's Ishmael who survives at the end. And by so doing, they're signaling a change in the self-confidence of the West as well. But for a Russian novelist like Dostoevsky, this necessity of suffering, the depth of that experience, of defeat, is already in the cards. It's already in the Russian myth. And this we see, of course, expressed formulaically in the epigraph, the brothers Karamazov, which he takes from the Gospel of John. Right, except a corn of wheat fall to the earth and die, it will not yield fruit, as the epigraph says. It abideth alone, but if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. So that notion is then brought up to a theological level without deserting all the mythic overtones that it's taken from Russian culture and from what Dostoevsky perceives about life in the modern Russia in his time. So we look back over his works leading up to Brothers K. We see in Notes from Underground, a young man, an intellect, a strong intellect, embittered by his intellect and turned by it against his society, against the world, and having to retreat into the underground. Crime and Punishment gives us a figure who does the same, except also to that he strikes out with his one bold plan, his one bold action, which is a horrible sacrilege against human life, to kill for no reason other than to bring about his supremacy as Raskolnikov. But Raskolnikov, unlike our underground man, goes farther and is actually saved by the suffering figure of grace and wisdom, the prostitute Sonya. Now, you know, fathers are missing in these works as well. Raskolnikov has a weak father. The father of Sonya is a drunkard who gets run over in the street. The masculine principle has lost part of its completeness There is no more sacred authority to be had structurally in the society. And then the idiot, I don't know, we've talked about some sort of background myth there, and it seems to me now that almost Mishkin is an attempt by Dostoevsky at reanimation of a pre-Christian myth. A sky god and an earth mother must get together and bring life back to their world. And yet it doesn't happen. Our sky god is one who doesn't understand earthly life, but wants nonetheless to redeem it, but doesn't know how. And the discovery that Dostoevsky makes with that novel, as he wrestles with it, is that this ideal of perfection that possesses our Mishkin means destruction. And at Nastasya's death, at the end of the novel, something has gone out of the Russian soul. So this is the greatest fall that is shown, perhaps, in all of his works. From that to the fall of the polis in the possessed is almost an equation. It's almost a given. Then in the devils, the possessed, our pseudo-messiah Stavrogin, who seems to promise the fulfillment of everyone's hopes. Someone to whom Russia looks, right, with that old longing, and yet Dostoevsky is also developing a theme learned from his friend Vladimir Soloviev. Vladimir, is that his first name? Soloviev. A theological writer in the Russian tradition who called this kind of figure that Stavrogin was an antichrist. So he is developing the antichrist figure through him. Yet we have to see at the same time that in killing himself, he is saying no to being used as an antichrist. And so his suicide is, in a sense, a heroic suicide, although it's one that is also true to his own strange and very troubled character. He's taking himself out of the picture so that he can't be used in the terrible way that Pyotr has in mind for him. And now recall the epigraph, too, of the possessed with the Gadarene swine. And at the end of that passage, you know, the man who was possessed by devils is now freed. And they went to see what was done and came to Jesus and found the man out of whom the devils were departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And that man then is Stepan. We see that scene at the end of the novel. As terrible as the destruction has been, Stepan has repented and comes to the foot of the cross before he dies. And left at the end of the novel are the little people, those whom the Sermon on the Mount is about, people who are poor in spirit, who mourn, who are meek. Right, I went back and printed these out. Who are reviled and persecuted, and so forth. And those are the people about whom the Sermon on the Mount is given, and those are the people in whose hands the spiritual destiny of the human race is, and not the heroes, the leaders, the ones with great ideas, with great plans, with great desires. Not even ones who believe Russia itself is the sacred idea. So all of this leading up to our final novel. And the Brothers Karamazov takes up all these themes and reorganizes them into a different totality. You might have noticed already the different pace of the narrative. Whereas something makes the devils frenetic and turbulent from the beginning. It's an eccentric beginning as it begins with Stepan. You never quite catch on to what the whole picture is until very late. With the brothers, there's a more serene pacing, and one in which we feel that our feet are on the ground with from the beginning. I haven't read any critic who's talked convincingly about the tone of the whole novel, but when we've moved at this speed from one novel to the next to the next, I think we notice a distinct difference. And it's a kind of a relief. And there we are in Skotoprigonyevsk. Is that close to it? Which I'm told can be translated roughly to mean pig pen. And with old Karamazov, the buffoon, and then on the other hand, the spiritual father, Zosima. We're introduced to these, first one in book one, second one in book two. We have a very strong, from the outset, a very strong New Testament theme of the two fathers, the fleshly and the spiritual father. The old Adam who must die. And not to give you any spoilers, but that's going to happen. And then the three sons. And the first one, passionate. And we've seen this kind of character in Rogozhin, but here, someone with more dignity, all right, and more of a sense of himself, more honor. One of them, intellectual, our bitter, embittered intellectual, whom we've seen in Raskolnikov in The Man from Underground, in Ippolit, and in Stavrogin, right, alienated, questioning, right, and always the darling of the literary critics who want to anoint him as the hero of the novel. I don't think that's still a trend, but it certainly was for a long time. And then finally, Alyosha, who is another try by Dostoevsky at something that he was, it seems, trying to start with the idiot when he set out to create a perfectly good figure. It's another try. Not a Mishkin figure himself, but one who does have alarmingly strange similarities in some of his tendencies. And then we have Katerina Ivanovna, right, the proud young lady who's like we have seen earlier in Aglaya and in Lisa in the Devils, and then Grushenka, right, our full-bodied Russian beauty of whom a supple curve runs throughout her body, symbolizing the earth, the focus of desire, Nastasya of the idiot, Sonya of Crime and Punishment, all very different characters, but all tapping into that same depth. So through these characters, that meta story that Dostoevsky has been after, whatever it may have been, is given another chance. And remembering that at the end of Crime and Punishment, when he writes the end of the epilogue, and that finally we have that embrace between Raskolnikov and Sonya, he says, I don't have it to quote with me, but he does say the story of what happens after this would take another novel entirely. So there's looking forward always. His novels propel to the future.
I never wrote another novel about those people that I could find.
No.
Because I thought that was his hint that he he was going to write a continuation, and I scoured
no.
libraries and couldn't find anything.
But he did want to write a large novel of which this one, The Brothers, was a part. Let's call this Life of a Great Sinner. Right. But I think, again, this was something that he worked through by the end of Brothers and was satisfied with what he had. Now we take, yes.
I wanted to ask about the connection between the characters like Drushenka and Lisa. With Sonya, it seems like she's sort of a combination of what you'll see in a figure like Nastasya and Aglaya. Like, he splits her character the same way he does between Mishkin and Robotsy. Does he do that with the hero in the same way?
I think those are debatable points. And, you know, you're going to have to look carefully at them. Sonya is a truly unique character because we think, you know, we have to be reminded after experiencing her and how she's this trembling and fearful character who, you know, and I asked my students in my sophomore class today, do you think Sonya thinks she's good? Well, no, she doesn't, you know. She does not approve of herself at all. But then you push her to the wall, and as Raskolnikov does, and say perhaps there's no God and so forth, and she turns into a fearsome defender of the faith. And the great scene follows with the reading of the resurrection of Lazarus there. And we get one of those beautiful moments that Dostoevsky creates of an iconic moment where he says the murderer, the prostitute, and between them the sacred book. You know, and we just, that just is burned into our minds as a picture, beautifully. Well, we have to be reminded that she is a prostitute from time to time. You know, and in that sense, with her strong religious leaning, we are reminded of the ancient sacred prostitutes. But she doesn't have an ounce of that feel, you know, in the novel. So something larger. Depending on it, it's quite likely that, quite possible, that she combined two strains that he will split later on to look at. But I don't see them quite. It doesn't split quite neatly in the figures that we see later. We do see pairs of women, don't we? In the Idiot. Here in the Brothers. And that's an interesting motif that he continues. All right, so if we look at the title. I'm going to suggest a contentious interpretation that goes a little bit against what Dr. Dupree has suggested, that, you know, Brothers Karamazov, right? You've got, on the one hand, multiplicity, on the other hand, one thing. Each is part of a whole. Right? Together, I mean, each separately is not a whole human being. And that notion, I too am a Karamazov, it sounds very much like the human race we're talking about being. And if we think of old Fyodor as old Adam, right, he is that figure that has engendered us all and makes us, you know, the mess that we are. We could clearly talk about the three brothers as body, mind, and soul, all right, or some division like that. But they are not meant to be allegories, and it's not a simple division that Dostoevsky is working at here. But we do know that Ivan and Alyosha have the same mother, right, and that is an important tie that brings them together. Alyosha is interested in Ivan. And her name is Sonya, again, which means Sophia, which means wisdom. So there is some allegorical notation in that descent. There's a moment early on in which Yvonne says to his father, "She was my mother too," and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'd forgotten." Correct. Fiore's drunk anyway. You know, but I think that's an interesting motif that we go through with the different mothers, Yvonne and Alyosha as full brothers, and Dmitri, a half brother, and then of course one more. But the organizing principle of the beginning of the novel is the sons coming home to claim their heritage. Fyodor basically has spent it all. Alyosha, he says he's come to find his mother's grave. Right, so if we think of his mother as Sophia, there's again something a little allegorical about that. And Dmitri, his honor is involved in this. He must undo his old debts, and he's tied to Katerina Ivanovna by his pride, tied to Grushenka, as we've come to realize, not just by lust, but by his heart. And he's torn in two. And Ivan, we see the pride and self-centeredness of that aristocratic figure that Dostoevsky has portrayed in different guises, that he is an aristocrat in spirit. This makes him touchy and self-centered and proud. Now, if you'll open your book and look at the very beginning, the passage from the author, we already hear a narrative voice in this foreword, even though it says it's from the author. He's begins by talking explicitly about his hero. "In beginning the life story of my hero, Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov, I find myself in something of a quandary. Namely, although I call Alexei Fyodorovich my hero," is it Fyodorovich?
First syllable.
Okay.
Fyodorovich.
It's hard to say. "I myself know that he is by no means a great man. And hence I foresee such unavoidable questions as these. What is so remarkable about your Alexei Fyodorovich that you have chosen him as your hero?" And so forth. Right? So he's, on one hand, he's my hero. On the other hand, he is not a great man. Right? And this is our novelistic duality. Right? This is the figure of the novel hero. And it goes on to say, very shockingly explicitly here, really, at the end of this, of the second paragraph, as he says, "One thing I dare say is fairly certain. This man is odd, even eccentric. But oddness and eccentricity interfere with, rather than help, in the uniting of the strands and in the finding of some sort of common meaning in the general confusion. In most cases, the eccentric is a particularity, a separate element. Isn't that so?" And we realize in the third paragraph, that this has been a red herring, a false lead, so that he can deny the case against the unimportance of the eccentric, and can come then to say, "Now, if you don't agree with that last thesis, you say it isn't always so, then, you see, for not only is an eccentric not always a particularity and a separate element, but on the contrary, it happens sometimes that such a person, I dare say, carries within himself the very heart of the universal, and the rest of the men of his epoch have, for some reason, been temporarily torn from it, as if by a gust of wind." His epoch, right? So an epoch can get so twisted, and he has just portrayed the novel in which he's shown drastically how that has happened, right? Can get so twisted that its central people no longer have an orientation toward the good, no longer have a heroic or otherwise you know, fulfilling orientation. And it takes, it flees and takes refuge out to these minor characters who have gotten some aspect of the whole, even though their characters are not equal to it, as people who translate a vision into action, translate love into action. Right? We've seen this, we've seen it, not just in, you know, some of my favorite references like Ishmael, or in Ike McCaslin, in Go Down Moses of Faulkner, but we've seen it back much, much earlier that in Dante the Pilgrim. You know, I, who am I to take this journey? Right, as Dante says. Right? I'm not Aeneas, I'm not Paul. Right? And it was said by one great Dante critic of our century, John Fichero, that the Divine Comedy was the first novel for that reason. Right? It's a nice case. I can't quite get used to calling it a novel, so, but it's a good case. The eccentric. Right? The eccentric. So Alyosha fits that description. And he's also young, he's innocent, he's untried, and he's all the quirks that he has. But Dostoevsky makes that case that in such a time of crisis, it's the eccentric who might carry the seed of the whole thing, right, the whole vision. Now, our narrator already is establishing himself as a fallible narrator, even here. But we've seen him from the very beginning of chapter 1 as a careful person who has found meaning in events of Skotoprigonyevsk and written about it 13 years later. And it's all brewed, perhaps, within him, and now he's writing it out. And the pattern throughout this novel does follow that epigraph that I quoted, that of to fall to the earth and die. Each of the brothers will fall to the earth and die. And the question is whether they will bring forth fruit. Right? And we not. The novel doesn't go on to develop that too long, so it remains a question, but it also is answered in some ways. All three brothers will have to be destroyed in some way, remade, even the innocent and good Alyosha. So we have in that the great theme of rebirth and resurrection, but not without suffering, suffering unto death, terrible agony, and the death of the old self which was egotistical illusion, and in order to submit to the truer totality of creation, its grace and its purpose, la vita nuova. Again, I'm referring to Dante's already done this pattern. It is the new life, la vita nuova, but not without falling to the earth and dying. So what that means, we have to discover in the action of these characters. So the themes of this novel, we could say, I could do a short list or medium-sized list, as saying money. Money, certainly, as it is in so many novels, as it is especially in 19th century novels. It's a great theme. Miracles, right? Memory. I could say also it's about obedience. It's about the elders and their meaning. It's about the holy fool, the buffoon, mad women, all of the various manifestations of the holy fool. You have to say it's about the icons. That early scene with the icon is very important. It's about father-son relationships. about something that Father Zosima enunciates in book two, active love, and it's about death. All these great themes are introduced in the first two books of the novel. The first one dominated by Fyodor, the second by Zosima. So let's look at Fyodor a little bit. All right, any questions or comments at this point? I'm going to turn and look at some pages as we go on. So from chapter 1 and the end of the first chapter, where we've already learned about Fyodor and his first marriage, and she died quite suddenly in a garret of typhus. And my translation, yours may be a little different. It's on page 4 for you, if you have the Norton critical edition. And the story is that he ran out into the street and began shouting with joy, raising his hands to heaven, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." But others say he wept without restraint, like a little child, so much so that people were sorry for him, in spite of the repulsion he inspired. So we see a complex figure. We don't want at all times perhaps to see a complex figure here, but we see one here. And it's thanks to those, some say, others say, right? We get it from the whole village. The whole village has got to be consulted here. And some saw part of it, some saw others. Our narrator says it's quite possible that both versions were true, that he rejoiced at his release and at the same time wept for her who released him. And then he says, as a general rule, people, even the wicked, are much more naive and simple-hearted than we suppose. And we ourselves are, too. So here is our 60-year-old Dostoevsky. Has a little bit of wisdom to say to us, right? And has a little more confidence that he can just say it occasionally with a certain straightforwardness. Not the author speaking, but the narrator whom he's created can occasionally. And this happens throughout the novel. So our first self-recognition in the novel comes on the occasion of old Fyodor. We recognize ourselves in him. The novelist has just achieved that. So he's disgusting, and yet somehow something we admire in him as well. And that then is continued further in his first meeting that we see with Father Zosima. It's actually continued with his second wife, and we're both repulsed and kind of admiring that he says, "Those innocent eyes slit my soul up like a razor." Oh, man. It's a testimony. At the same time, it's a repulsive way of telling us how it's affected him. With it. He seems to debase it, no question about it. Now, his wife suffers from a kind of disorder that peasant women have after having delivered, because they have had to bear so much. Right, so this is a gathering together of a whole theme of suffering in Russia. Right. And we see then in that chapter 3, the second marriage, the second family, on page 8, you see him talk about little Alexei when she died. When she died, little Alexei was in his fourth year. And strange as it seems, I know, says our narrator, that he remembered his mother all his life, like a dream, of course. Right.
How far into the third chapter is that?
That's about 2 or 3 pages in. And you look at then this whole sequence of events that happens after this, that last paragraph of the chapter. No, it's not. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's the same page. Exactly 3 months after Sofya Ivanovna's death, the general's widow suddenly appeared in our town and went straight to Fyodor Pavlovich's house. Now, this is the woman who has mistreated Sofya. right? So she spent only half an hour in the town, but she did a great deal. This evening, Fyodor Pavlovich, whom she had not seen for those 8 years, came into her drunk. The story is that instantly upon seeing him, without any sort of explanation, she gave him two good resounding slaps on the face, seized him by a tuft of hair, and shook him three times up and down. We get a real feeling of satisfaction out of this happening, don't we? Then, without a word, she went straight to the cottage to the two boys, seeing at the first glance that they were unwashed and in dirty linen. She promptly gave Grigory, too, a box on the ear, and announcing that she would carry off both the children, she wrapped them just as they were in a robe. Grigory accepted the blow like a devoted slave without a word, and when he escorted the old lady, he pronounced impressively that God would repay her for the orphans. "You are a blockhead all the same," the old lady shouted to her as she drove away. So, yeah. Certainly the comic touch is in a scene like this, but it's all mixed with a whole mixture of feelings that we have at the terrible death of this woman who's been so terrible and whom Fyodor has been so terribly untrue to, has turned his house into a harem because she was unable to protest, really, basically, unable to do anything but suffer it, and all of the terrible things that he's done. But that whole theme of memory haunts this chapter, and we see then perhaps a page later, three pages later. I'm going to move to chapter 4. I'm sorry. It's the beginning of chapter 4, which I think is on page 13 for you. Again, now the focus is on Alyosha. And it's a memory that he has of his mother. I've mentioned already, by the way, it says in the first paragraph, I've mentioned already, by the way, that though he lost his mother in his fourth year, he remembered her all his life, her face, her caresses, as though she stood living before me. Such memories may persist, as everyone knows, from an even earlier age, even from 2 years old, but scarcely standing out through a whole lifetime, like spots of light out of darkness, like a corner torn out of a huge picture, which has all faded and disappeared except that fragment. That is how it was with him. He remembered one still summer evening, an open window, slanting rays of the setting sun. That he recalled most vividly of all. In a corner of the room, the holy image, before it, a lighted lamp, and on her knees, before the image, his mother, sobbing hysterically with cries and moans, snatching him up in both arms, squeezing him close till it hurt, and praying for him to the Mother of God, holding him out in both arms to the image, as though to put him under the mother's protection. And suddenly a nurse runs in and snatches him from her in terror. That was the picture. And Alyosha remembered his mother's face at that minute. He used to say that it was frenzied but beautiful, as he remembered. So it's an incredible motif that he carries through here. First of all, you know, he does a very good job of this, of describing that kind of little fragmentary, intense memory that you or I might have about some moment in our earliest childhood. It's a very human thing. Usually it's not such a dramatic thing. Obviously he's pumped it up on steroids here, right? But look at the way the scene develops. Those fragmented things come first, the still summer evening, the rays of the setting sun, and then it zooms in on this scene of frantic emotion. And then it is suddenly cut short as the nurse comes and snatches it away. Amazing. Amazing scene. That was the picture. And Alyosha, you know, we do carry an image, a is, and this is the iconic, right? How the whole thing carries a meaning that's far more than can be spoken in words. But it ties him to his mother in a way that nothing else really could. So it goes on, in that same long paragraph, it goes on to talk about him. But he was fond of people. He seemed throughout his life to put implicit trust in people. Yet no one ever looked on him as a simpleton or naive person. There was something about him which made one feel at once, and it was so all his life afterwards, that he did not care to be a judge of others, that he would never take it upon himself to criticize and would never condemn anyone for anything. He seemed indeed to accept everything without the least condemnation, though often grieving bitterly. And we see this, of course, as an accurate description of what happens very shortly after this. So here is our young man who takes it all in without judging, right? Takes in the whole picture, right? But not without judging, but not without fear, not without grieving bitterly sometimes. And we now can't think that Dostoevsky could have created this figure without comparing him in his mind to Mishkin, our other innocent figure. And both are careless of money. Both are guileless. Both don't judge others, right? But it's really the work of the whole novel to make us see that they're not the same, that Alyosha has that potential that Mishkin simply fails to have. So, now, his father, same paragraph, long paragraph, very end of the paragraph, talks about his father and his relation to Alyosha. His father, who had once been in a dependent position and was sensitive and ready to take offense, met him at first with distrust and sullenness. Now remember, met him at first. There's this whole motif of the father meets the sons for the first time, because he's simply not cared about them, sent them off and left them to their own devices. And it's been Grigory who's raised them all. He does not say much, he used to say, and thinks the more. But soon, within a fortnight indeed, he took to embracing him and kissing him terribly often, with drunken tears, with sottish sentimentality. Yet he evidently felt a real and deep affection for him, such as he had never been capable of feeling for anyone before. So we have that close bond with his father, which is, you know, as much a disadvantage as it is an advantage. But it's a testimony to Alyosha himself. Now, let's go on and look at the beginning of chapter 5. As we see again, our narrator tell us more about Alyosha. Some of my readers may imagine, he starts, that my young man was a sickly, ecstatic, poorly developed creature, a pale, consumptive dreamer. So here he addresses that directly. On the contrary, Alyosha was at this time a well-grown, red-cheeked, clear-eyed lad of 19, radiant with health. He was very handsome, too, graceful, moderately tall, and so forth. Wide-set, dark, gray, shining eyes. And he goes on to say, but I fancy that Alyosha was more of a realist than anyone. And you know that the term realist and realism is a loaded term, especially for a novelist, right? So, oh, no doubt in the monastery he fully believed in miracles. So what's the relation between realism and believing in miracles? What's the unrelation? We've talked about that earlier in this course, that the novel has to believe in a naturalistic explanation for things. No doubt in the monastery he fully believed in miracles, but to my thinking, miracles are never a stumbling block to the realist. It is not miracles that dispose realists to belief. The genuine realist, if he is an unbeliever, will always find strength and ability to disbelieve in the miraculous. And if he is confronted with a miracle as an irrefutable fact, he would rather disbelieve his own senses than admit the fact. Even if he admits it, he admits it as a fact of nature till then unrecognized by him. And you know this is true. Faith does not, in the realist, spring from the miracle, but the miracle from faith. And here again, we hear that voice that is axiomatic and that we didn't hear in Dostoevsky's earlier novels. Faith does not, in the realist, spring from the miracle, but the miracle from faith. Now, we know this novel, or if we don't, we may or may not know, but this novel is going to talk about miracles a good bit. So this is important. If the realist once believes, then he is bound by his very realism, to admit the miraculous also. This is, incidentally, is related to Dostoevsky's novelistic craft, because for him, he talked about his realism. He said, people call my style psychological realism. This is not what I would call it. I simply call it the higher realism. Because if people do things that can only be really make sense or be explained by supernatural connections, by a divine context, context of grace and so forth, then who's the realist? Isn't the realist the person who will see that thing and admit it, rather than one who will obstinately say, there's nothing here but naturalistic causes? So this is what he meant by the higher realism. And he invokes the Apostle Thomas, right, who said that he would not believe till he saw, but when he did see, he said, "My Lord and my God." So was it the miracle forced him to believe? Most likely not. So the Apostle Thomas is our realist. So he does go on to say that Alyosha is to some extent a youth of our last epoch. So all of these characters are youths of his last epoch, and if we subtract 13 years from 1881, we get 1868. It puts us back in the turbulent 60s that the previous novels were all about. Right? That same era of great ideological upheaval and actual terrorism, as the burning of Petersburg would exemplify. All right. So now, but Alyosha goes on, and is more characterized here himself as a young idealist. As he says, the path Alyosha chose was a path going in the opposite direction from those who says sacrifices utterly beyond the strength of the world. But he chose it with the same thirst for swift achievement. As soon as he reflected seriously, he was convinced of the existence of God and immortality, and at once he instinctively said to himself, "I want to live for immortality, and I will accept no compromise." In the same way, if he had decided that God and immortality did not exist, he would at once have become an atheist and a socialist. For socialism, he goes on to say here again, our wise narratorial voice, is not merely the labor question. It is before all things the atheistic question. The question of the form taken by atheism today. The question of the Tower of Babel, built without God, not to mount to heaven from earth, but to set up heaven on earth. Oh. You know, this sentence takes us away from our concern for Alyosha and looks back over all the novels that Dostoevsky has written about those turbulent 1860s in Russia. The Tower of Babel. But look at our young hero. "I want to live for immortality." Heroic, right? But he says, but that thirst for swift achievement. There is, if anything, an unrealism in this in our young man. And as we say, if we go on and look on, later in the chapter, and I believe it's your page 24, after Zosima has been characterized, it talks about him, and Alyosha has a paragraph in which he responds. He says, no matter. He is holy. He carries in his heart the secret of renewal for all. Right? That power which will at last establish truth on the earth, and all men will be holy and love one another, and yet there will be no more rich nor poor, no exalted nor humble, but all will be as the children of God, and the true kingdom of Christ will come. That was the dream in Alyosha's heart. That's thrilling, isn't it? But at the same time, it's too easy, right? You're reminded of a contestant for a Miss World who says, world peace! I want world peace! No, it's not going to happen. Right? And if he remained with this youthful idealism, unconfronted by all of the difficulties it immediately brings up in reality, it would lead to destruction. And I think Dostoevsky has probed that theme tremendously. It's going to come about only with great difficulty, with hard work, and Alyosha has no notion of that at this point. In part, that's part of the burden we begin to see with what Zosima stresses in the next book. So all the brothers, in that sense, are idealists, right? Even Alyosha, and Alyosha too, has to submit to a kind of death that will be briefer than the suffering of the others, but it will be intense. And there will be the possibility that he too could be lost, because the true suffering and falling to earth, like the epigraph suggests, has to involve that real risk. The old self must die. Comments, anyone? We're going to go on and look more carefully at our next set of readings. And there will be a quiz next time.
Okay. Do you have any borrowed verses to get back to?
Almost. I'm sorry. But they're almost ready. And we'll have a bunch for you next time.